The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
It's So Fluffy by Daniel Rogers. The elite guard is waiting on the other side of the temple gate to arrest me, which is going to make it very hard to get to the ladder god. And if I can't get there, there's no way I can sacrifice myself. You could stuff me in a saddlebag again. I can't believe I just said that. Not that I have anything against saddlebags, but the beast the saddlebag is attached to is a whole different ball of wax. Those tiger-like dignits and I don't get along. Actually, it's just me, but who can blame me? They have very sharp teeth, and their bone structure is, well, terrifying. Oh, sure, they look cute, and so far they have only licked me and tried to play catch, but I can see through their cute facade. Don't you think it will be obvious if the sacrifice isn't anywhere to be seen? They don't call it the last march of the sacrifice for no reason. Alora is a stinking genius. Nothing gets past her robotic mind. Although Bob had said something about ritual costumes, I wonder how elaborate we can get. Alora said this more to herself than to me. Thoughts of Halloween on Earth filled my head. Ghosts, movie characters, princesses, and monsters. Of course, those costumes are all fine and dandy on Earth, but what kind would this planet use? Alora spoke up. We need to talk with Bob. The only way to get past the elite guard is with the disguise. I don't see it any other way. We found Bob meditating in his quarters. You are here to discuss the elite guard. Bob hadn't opened his eyes, nor had we said a word. How did you know? I asked. The ladder god reveals all. Alora and I looked doubtfully at each other. The whole god thing is getting a little out of hand. All right, know-it-all. What are we to do? I asked. Bob stood with a smile. I forgot you're a god. Forgive me. I suppose you're not impressed by conversations with deities since you do it every time you talk to yourself. Alora had all she could take. Bob, you're way off. Drew isn't a god. He's just a plain, ordinary man, as plain as a loaf of bread or a stick or a rock. I think he gets the idea, I interrupted. Bob laughed gently. I believe you're the one way off. He's a great god. Not as great as the latter god, of course, but I've foreseen that our future will be tremendously better because of him. I give up, Alora said. Sure, Drew is great. Why not? But how are we going to get his great butt up that ladder? The elite guard isn't going to let it happen. Although you'd think a god could take care of those mortal pesky guards. She pointed this last comment towards me with a smirk. Your idea will work, Alora, Bob said. It takes a lot to shock an android, but she rallied well. What idea? The one you suggested to Drew. Yeah, I'm going to need you to say it. Alora, your faith is very weak, but if it will help, I'll spell it out for you. You want to know if we can disguise Drew effectively enough to slip past the elite guard, and the answer is yes, but you might not like it. Alora stood dumbfounded. I could see her robotic mind smoking and hissing, trying to figure out how Bob had known about our secret conversation that had taken place on the other side of the temple. How do you know about our conversation? I've already told you, but you don't believe me. If I tell you again, will you believe me? I don't think so. So I'm going to ignore your question and get right to the point. Only the priests and I know that Drew is a sacrifice. There's no reason for the elite guard to suspect he'll be in the march. I have a costume that requires two people to wear. If you're willing, Alora, we will be able to sneak both of you past the elite guard. I'm willing, but you haven't said anything about the costume, which is causing me to worry. That's because you're wise. Really bad at faith, but very wise. And with that, Bob went back to meditating. Throughout the night, a throng of priests used flowers, lit candles, and silky materials. Can anyone say fire hazard? To decorate wheelbarrows like parade floats. Bob couldn't have been more correct about his costume. We hated it. The three of us faced off in a battle of wills that Bob would eventually win, but Alora and I held out for as long as possible. Each minute outside, the hideously cute costume felt like a victory, but we had to give in if we wanted to avoid the elite guard, and Bob knew it. There's no use arguing. The sooner you put it on, the sooner we begin the march, Bob said. I'm the head, I said. Alora grabbed the half of the costume with the head. I don't think so. I resigned myself to the rear, and we left for the march. The priests went crazy when we walked out, cheering and hooting. It took some cooperation for the two of us to walk the beastly thing, but we quickly figured it out. I'm just glad no one can see me, walking as the back legs of this full-size pink dignit with big cutesy eyes and a blue bow tied around the neck in the most embarrassing thing I've ever done. Don't forget to wag the tail, Alora commanded, and that just added to the indignity. My job involved following Alora. I heard the cheering crowds, the priest's prayers of thanksgiving, and Bob giving a blessing to the masses. I could hear, but I saw nothing, which is expected when you're bringing up the rear. We marched for over an hour before arriving at the Ladder God's sacred site. Bob helped us out of our imprisonment and pointed to the ladder. There it is, the ladder to the Ladder God's abode. I stared in amazement. The ladder stood over 100 feet into the air, suspended from an unmoving storm cloud. No wonder the locals thought a god had parked here. If I'd never seen a chameleon shield before, I would have thought the same. But I have, and this is clearly a ship hiding behind a chameleon shield. Bob had already told me I wouldn't be climbing the ladder today. We had feasts, dances, poetry recitals, and a concert before we got to the actual sacrifice. For right now, I just stared at the ladder, thinking about everything that had led up to this point. The tournament, the chase by the elite guard, the crash landing, it all brought me here. And now that I'm looking at how high the ladder is, I just realized something really important. I'm terrified of heights. And Fanima by Grace Kelly. Zinni could see her breath. It was a bitter cold morning in February, and she was the only one out on the boardwalk so early. Occasionally on her daily runs, she would see another runner or two, but not many were up at such an early hour, and fewer still were devoted enough to brave such a cold, raw morning. The sun hadn't even risen yet, and the numbness in her fingers made her think it might have been the morning to stay in bed and skip it. No, not today, she thought. She must run at least 3 miles every morning. Without the workout to get her blood pumping, the entire rest of her day would feel off. To her, it was better than even a morning coffee to get her awake and focused. She was strict about her daily routines. They were what kept her from drowning in all of her ambitions and commitments. She looked at her watch as she reached her door. 6 minutes, 23 seconds per mile. Not bad, but not her best. Time is precious, and she couldn't allow herself to waste any of it. She had graduated from Cornell when she was 19, with degrees in both physics and biology. She had some credits carried over from taking college-level coursework when she was still in high school. She graduated from high school when she was only 16. Zinnia completed her Ph.D. in biophysics from Stanford in only 4 years, beginning her postdoc when she was just 23. Efficiency meant everything to her. Time is the most precious gift we're given, she often thought. We never know when ours will run out. She learned that lesson early after losing her twin sister at 11. She still wished she had more time with her, but her sister, Sophia, had run out of time. If only the ambulance had got there quicker. If only Zinni had found her sooner. If only she had made it in time, but she hadn't, and Sophia ran out of time. Zinni would make the most of her time in this life and never be late for anything again. That particular day in February was no exception. She showered, got ready for work, and grabbed breakfast all within 25 minutes. She made her way to the MIT campus. She lived close enough to walk, in 5 minutes. She got there earlier than necessary, but not earlier than was typical for her. Zinni was never late for anything. She spent some time in her lab reviewing some findings and made some finishing touches on slides and reviewed her talking points before heading to a seminar where she was to discuss her most recent research. She looked at her watch. She would speak for 30 minutes. This is Species N. Van Ma, our most recent discovery from the exoplanet T7-3e. The screen behind her showed what looked like a large, dark, iridescent form that seemed the consistency of silly putty. We're not sure yet how to classify it. We consider it a life form, but the chemical structure is like nothing we've ever seen before. In fact, every molecule seems to defy physics in ways I'll describe shortly in the cells, if we can call them that, do not function in the same way as anything on Earth. We try to take slides of the cells, but as we look at them under the microscope, they seem to come and go. Zinni then brought a picture of the slide to the screen. As you can see, they appear to disappear without any explanation. And then there, it appears again. Something to do with how the molecules are reflecting light, it has to be, a student called out. Not so. You see, I haven't provided all the information. Something to do with light, yes, that was my initial hypothesis. However, equally as curious, the mass of the specimen is incredibly sporadic. It grows and shrinks without consuming or releasing anything. We've put it in a vacuum and it still changes unpredictably. That is the mystery to be solved. She continued discussing possibilities and other qualities of the life form discovered. Then she left 15 minutes at the end to answer questions. After the seminar was over, she returned to her lab. The picture on the slides did not do specimen justice, for the creature was enormous, until it wasn't. As she walked in, the creature took up the entirety of the glass-enclosed room it was kept in. As she sat down at her computer, the creature became just a small puddle on the floor. Zinni looked at the creature. How endlessly curious it was. She could study this alien specimen for the rest of her life and never tire of it. She would never run out of new discoveries. From her research so far, it seemed as soon as she had figured out an answer to one of Enfanema's mysteries, it would only unravel more and more questions. It was watching her again. She felt it. Perhaps it was just as curious of her as she was of it. But it had no eyes. No, she thought. She was being silly. She could not waste time imagining such things. She wondered what kind of senses it had, if it did indeed have any at all. Could it even be considered living? She decided to get another sample of the specimen. She had some ideas for some new tests to run. Zinni opened the door to the enclosed room. The creature was still a small puddle on the floor. It was a funny substance and seemed to be uninjured when you cut a bit off. It didn't really seem to react either, and she had no problems taking samples. But this time, as she bent down to take her sample, the creature suddenly expanded and engulfed Zinni. The creature enclosed around her so quickly that she had no time to react or think about what was happening. Slowly, the life form released her and returned again to a puddle at her feet. Her feet? Those were not the shoes she had been wearing. Nor were those her feet. They were smaller. But the sneakers. She remembered those sneakers. She had them as a child. She had painted them. She saw the artwork she had been so proud of. "Zinni!" she heard a voice call out, and she looked up. There before her eyes was her sister, Sophia, standing as she once knew her at 11 years old. Perhaps time was not what Zinni had thought. That Which Doomed July by Charles C. Gould. July 25, 2226. Why must the sky be a sickly, smog-smoked gray? Why must the water in our clouds melt our tongues in salt and land? Why must we accept the times our forefathers forsook with us? A low hum shook the break room. The tremor shook me out of my daze as I sat straighter on the break room cinder sofa, the plastic frills squeaking with my movement. The man on the screen, Senator Vail, broad-shouldered and teeth bright, stood in front of a holographic blue sky as artificial as his veneers. I'd always hated watching the news. It was one thing to see the polluted misery of Earth in 2226 with my own eyes, but it was intolerable to have it spoon-fed by fake smiles and pressed suits. Killing the feed, I turned to find Dr. Simmons in the doorway. "Politicians," Dr. Simmons scoffed. "They think they can suck out the poison with speeches and pretty words." As I turned around, my ash-blackened hair lashed across my face in inky tendrils. "At least they're talking about it now." "Bah," the old man chortled. "Talking is for therapists and pleasure bots. What we're doing is the cure." Truthfully, I didn't know much about what he did. The internship involved more carting coffee and printing paperwork than meaningful research. It was at a college job fair that the name first struck me. Pandorium Meteorological Solutions. Pandorium. It echoed like a far-off planet beyond the orbital strip nines. At the time, it surprised me that no one else signed up. A company working to restore the planet was a dream I'd only glimpsed in an old magazine laced with dust and forgotten smells. Instead, I'd been confined to the break room floor of the 100th floor bunker, brewing and printing and brewing and printing. "Tell me, Eli, what is it you believe we work on down in the depths of this bunker?" A tremor shook the break room. I stumbled. "Atmospheric remediation," I hesitated as the old scientist knowing hazel eyes bore into me. "That's what the pamphlet..." "Yes, remediation. Fixing. Always fixing. The sky leaks pollution like pus from an infected wound, and still the world believes our weather towers and algae farms will relieve its affliction." Dr. Simmons had worked at this company for 20 years. How could he say this? "Then why are we here?" The scientist's voice shifted to a conspiratorial caw. "Eli, you're under an NDA, are you not? You're a smart boy. You'd never leak any of the things you saw here." The question had teeth to it. Was this the day I'd been waiting for? Was this the day I'd venture into the concrete labyrinth and emerged with what I came here for? "You come work here someday and I'll give you a private tour." He looked at me with that expectant glare people give when they know they can squeeze out praise. Plastering over my hesitation was a grimacing smile. "I'll hold you to it." A tremor shook the break room. "Ah, that reminds me." A tremor shook the break room. Simmons stumbled, the coffee that I'd handed him last shift making a lukewarm collage out of his lab coat. He produced a purple handkerchief emblazoned with the squid-headed mascot of Pandorium, whipping in intentional sweeps. "Damn it, what do we pay maintenance for? What's wrong with it? Is everything okay?" It was embarrassing, sounding like a child asking his father to check for monsters under the bed. "Nothing, it's just the idiots in the temporal sector." "Temporal? Like time travel?" My mind raced to the old sci-fi holotapes Mom used to collect and force the whole family to watch until the rain melted a hole from the TV to the attic. Dr. Simmons looked at me like a bad smell. He was rigid and rooted in place, as if he had been caught in a hunting snare. "You know what? I'm old enough. If they sue, they'll have to exhume my corpse. I like you. You're a clever boy, too clever to cart around cheap synthetic coffees all day." I glowed at the compliment even as he checked his shoulder and quickened his breath. "Tell you what, I'll pull some strings and get you a job, a real job as my research assistant. For the time being, I'll let you in on what we really do here." It was the day. I knew it. This wasn't a waste of a summer. I'd get that job. The disappointment of being melted from my chest as the doctor cupped his hands around my ears. His breath was hot and humid. The words began to march out of their whispering cave. "Time is our one true enemy." What did that even mean? "Sir, what are you saying?" "Time was the greatest accomplice to our ancestors. Oh, how they relished their time." Bitterness flooded the old scientist's voice. "More time to mine, more time to make meaning out of the meaningless. They built and built and burned till they reached the sky, and the sky boiled them back to the ground, the acid rain, the poisoned water, the deaths of every species, and man who couldn't hide behind concrete roofs. I was alive for it. I lived as a child in the penthouses. We were the first to boil. Mother shielded me from the first storm as her skin blistered and melted on the patio floor. Here we fight time, and we've been fighting in the same bunker in this same damn month for 50 accursed years." The words collected in my chest like swallowed glass. "The same month?" I repeated. July 22, 26. Simmons folded the handkerchief back into his breast pocket as if he'd done it 10,000 times. I begin to think maybe he had. 50 years of the same July, give or take a Tuesday. Questions. So many questions. The thoughts engaging in a melee to escape my mouth. "Why July?" The unworthy victor limped from my throat. "The collapse, July 26, the day the great storm shears humanity from Earth like a cruel tumor. No one outside the bunkers survives. We can't stop the storm. Hell, even if we stopped every drill and factory, it'd only delay the reckoning by a week. That's why this bunker was built, to find a way to turn back time to the year 2026 and divert this world from its destruction. Every month we try to find the signal, the way to turn back before the tipping point, and every month we fail." He smoothed the front of his stained lab coat. "Then we'll go try again next month. Wait, does that mean I've been here for 50 years? "Yes, Eli, I've known you longer than my son. I know everything about you, about your mother, about Abby. I know you must have infinite questions, but luckily, we have infinite time." "Why don't I remember if you do?" The doctor's manic eyes turned solemn. "I'm the caretaker of this facility. It is not yours or any other's burden to bear. It is the way the machine was designed." Before I could respond, the intercom blared, the metal box above the break room box shaking as a tremor rattled the room. "We did it! We actually did it! The frequency we're getting out of here in 10. A tremor roared through the room that shook me to my molars. "We finally found it!" Simmons abandoned our conversation as he turned to kiss the black box. A tremor shook. 9, 8. A rattling. 7, 6. Dr. Simmons. A shake. 5, 4. Instability reading. The air grew hot. 3, 2. Reality anchor critical overload. The room stopped shaking. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6, 6, error. A whine echoed through the lab like a wounded songbird. Had my eyes always been closed? I thought as the blackness in front of me peeled open. My head ached. 25, 22, 26 July. I was on the ground, that much was certain. The intercom had stopped its counting. Simmons had stopped his cheering. The tremors and their shaking resonance had ceased. It felt different. The break room lights flickered as an uninterrupted shine bathed my prone form. The smell of new cars and battery acid bathed my nostrils. I stood, my knees creaking in a fluid hinge, patting gaseous dust off my blazer sleeve as I scanned the room. There it was. Simmons' lab jacket nestled in a pale shadow. I tugged. It came loose and floated down into my grasp. My thoughts felt heavy. What was going on? Perhaps I should check the sleeve pocket for the doctor. Some part of me thought it ludicrous, yet still I shoved a slender finger into the expanse of the jacket as my thigh brushed against the coffee spill, covering my limb in purple bruise-like splotches. Was coffee always purple? I muttered to myself. Surely it was. I remembered it no other way. Who am I to deny reality? The lukewarm coffee boiled on my skin, yet it didn't hurt. I needed to find the doctor. Certainty entered my brain and flowed out like ebbing waters. The break room was the break room. I was certain of this. The synth fur sofa sat where it had always sat, its lovely polyester tufts wiggling and beckoning me to take a seat. Where could he be? Glancing at the break room fridge, a thought came to me, forcing itself into my cognition. That's it, the vegetable crisper. I sat on the couch and stretched my arm to the freezer door, pushing it open to reveal the doctor, sprawled in the small compartment. Can't you see I'm working? He was indeed working. His back contracted and his limbs were wrapped on top of each other like the twisted tails of 1,000 rats. I knew it was wrong to distract someone in their studies, but I needed to ask him why things felt different. I looked at the doctor, his face nestled in a sea of carrots. Or were they peppers, maybe plums, maybe bones? Do things seem odd to you? His breath steamed. No. The reality anchor ensures that. Take my key card. The elevator will take you down to the labs. Go and see for yourself. The elevator came shooting up from the depths of the labyrinth and distended its great metal maw to receive me. Simmons pressed the key card into my palm. I turned it over. My intern badge had never included elevator access, but I had been promoted. I was fairly certain of that. Had the elevator always made that sound? I looked inside. It was a widening, conic staircase of concrete blocks with stretching plastic railings. It widened and contracted like the diaphragm of some great beast of the night. From holes in the blocks belched black smoke. Elevators, I thought, have always been staircases. If something were wrong, I'd know it. I began to descend. Floor 99. The steps squelched as I descended the passage. 1, 2, 3. I counted my steps. A good research assistant always keeps tally. That's who I am and always was. The intern chapter of my life was nothing but a regrettable stepping stone. A humiliating, degrading, insulting, resentful, insanity introducing... Hey, intern, join the party. A flash of anger boiled in my marrow. I was no intern. I whipped my shoulder to face the voice. Tom Payton, the sales rep, laughed at the indignant look as the ice of his margarita spilled on the gold-plated floor below. The room was garish in its excess. Gold lined every alcove as a throng of suited men imbibed on drinks that cost more than my apartment. Music leaked from the pores of the walls as dancing sent groveling groans from the gilded floorboards. Tom tightened his arm around my shoulder. Come on, we're celebrating. This was a place of business. I didn't understand. Why are we doing that? What is this place? Tom laughed in a breathy moan. The frequency, they found it. We're going to be rich. He handed me a purple chalice. I wanted to drink. Truly, I did. The chalice smelled of pastel color, streaks of violet and scarlet that eased the senses like seraphim censer. The glass in my chest tore internally. No, thank you. Tom looked offended. His eyes narrowed and his voice grew thick. You do know with the spindle frequency we're gods. Time is our slave now, just like our ancestors. Once maintenance fixes the anchor, we'll own the world. I remembered something jumbled in the shaken recesses of my brain. Dr. Simmons' explanation. Wasn't this facility built to go back in time so we could prevent the ecological collapse? Tom swatted the question like a gnat. Do you know how much money we could make with a proto-drill in 2026? The deposits are practically free for the taking. You'd go 200 years in the past to drill? The salesman looked at me as if I were a slow child struggling with a simple equation. Why else would you build this place? Untouched lithium deposits, pre-exhausted oil fields, 2 centuries of compounding interest. Think of the capital. I suddenly didn't enjoy the celebration anymore. As I left, purple blood leaked from the musical pores of the walls as the partygoers opened their jaws to catch the droplets in their mouths like kids with snowflakes before they first scalded your tongue in acid burns. I descended deeper. Floor 90. Steam bellowed out from the open door. I peeked my head inside. The room was a massive cavern of sheer rock, exposed mineral veins, and white oil paint. Pipes wrapped around every bit of open ground as I shoveled to avoid falling into the great mounds of coal dust that lined the floor. The pale-faced and soot-covered staff ignored these hazards, banging into the webs of obstacles in rhythmic collisions. They drilled at the rock with their handheld proto-drills, their faces blank and eyes glazed. You're researchers, are you not? Why are you doing this? No one responded until one did. A murmur sounded from a scientist in a Harvard sweatshirt as he picked up a dropped chunk. They don't need researchers now that the spindle is found. The pay's good. My voice grew shrill. What about your mission? What about the planet? The pay's good, he repeated. He coughed up black phlegm. I could feel a cough coming as well. I continued my descent. It continued for what felt like years, time blurring as each whisper of excess and suffering leaked from the metal-bolted doors. Bottom floor reality anchor. The sturdy latch groaned open as I braced myself for the imposing machine controlling this nightmare. Except there was no machine. Or at least nothing I'd ever expect. It was a metal gurney like what they used to cart off protesters. But instead of some righteous agitator, it was a little girl. Her cheeks were gaunt and her breathing slow. Her complexion was gray with the slightest pink in her cheeks. Her body was the size of my little sister's, but her skin was wrinkled and worn as if it had been stripped from an old nursemaid and crudely shaped onto her little form. My mind cleared. I could see the horror in her eyes. What is going on? I demanded more of the world than the child before me. I am July, a faint voice whispered. The words were wrong. They had none of the softness of youth. An old record recording scratched from years of decay. What could I say? Her skin was translucent. My eyes traced the geography of her bones and her purple veins. What are they keeping you here for? I am the anchor. These are my years. I felt like I was hallucinating. My head felt like it would rupture. What do you mean? I don't understand. To stabilize the procedure, to give time, to give riches, years must be exchanged in return. I am these years, and this is the siphon to my youth. I've given them every month for 50 years, give or take a Tuesday. Simmons' words. He knew. He knew. Let me get you out of here, I pleaded. No, July responded. You can make more children. You can't make more time. Her voice was mature and confident, like a soldier marching to her final battle. The 200 years taken from me would reduce me to dust, but it's worth it if we can save the world from a fate where we need something like this. July motioned at the apparatus she was strapped to. Spread the word. Make them see. Are you sure? I can take care of you. I used to have a little sister before the storm. I can take care of you. In my mind, I'd begged her. She'd say no. Instead, a spindly finger pointed at a gauge calibrated to the year 2026 in bold letters and a purple button beside it. Press it. She motioned a smile, glancing across her face. Destroy this place and save our planet. And Eli, please walk in the rain. For me, I've always wanted to do that. The glass in my chest was confused, its edges stabbing yet dulled. The button was pressed, and the girl was ash in an instant. Tears leaked onto the purple gooed ground. I followed the railing of the stairs to the fuel room. The kerosene bucket was heavy in my hands as I clambered the steps outside the soot-covered room. It was time to ascend. Ground floor, July 26, 2026. The sky was blue, the bunker burnt behind me. Rain washed the purple stain off my leg as white dandelions brushed against my toes. I cowered, yet the rain didn't scald. The city loomed past the rolling hills of green grass I'd only seen in textbooks. The earth felt calm, alive. I started to walk. Hole by Karina Magyar. Everyone, everything is just a pattern of molecules, he told the children. Even the most different things you can think of, like peanut butter and a big fire truck. They're just different patterns of molecules held together by bonds. Even the ingredients probably aren't much different. You're mostly looking at carbon and hydrogen and oxygen when you walk around. Rearrange those few things a tad differently, throw in traces of other elements, and you get the whole variety of everything on Earth. Isn't that amazing? The kids had no response. Joseph, what's the weirdest thing you can think of? Joseph picked his head up off his desk. What? What's the weirdest thing you can think of? Joseph smirked. A booger. The class laughed, but not too hard, and the teacher was able to jump right in. Okay, that's great. Depending on what you put up your nose, Joseph, a booger is usually going to just be a little bit of dust. That's carbon, coated in the slime your body makes, which, believe it or not, is almost all water. That's hydrogen and oxygen. So a booger is the same thing as a swimming pool shrunk down onto your nose. Quentin, what's the weirdest thing you can think of? A cat dog? A cat dog? Yeah, he repeated, giggling. A cat dog. Cat and a dog smushed together. Okay, well, that illustrates my point perfectly, because cats and dogs are made of the same atoms, the same ones that make you and I, and they just get arranged in different patterns at the teeny tiny levels we can't see with our eyes. And those differences in shape and the way the shapes cling to each other, that's all it takes to make a cat or a dog or a cat dog. So, Quentin jumped in, so I could make a frog dog too? He was cracking himself up here along with a few other kids. Well, if you knew exactly how to break apart and rearrange atoms, which is something we kind of know how to do in theory, but have an impossible time doing in practice, then yes, you could sit in your room and make a frog dog. But Mr. Beecham, said Juniper from the corner with her hand raised, if everything is the same stuff, how come some stuff feels smooth and some stuff feels scratchy? Great question, Juniper. So even though everything has the same ingredients, it has different shapes. And those different shapes make different surfaces. Some of the shapes are very, very even, and that makes the surfaces feel smooth. Some of the shapes are very irregular, very jagged, and that makes the surfaces feel scratchy. It's the shape that makes the difference far more than what it's made of. Great question. Mr. Beecham, the hand raised now came from right next to his desk, from Evan, a curious child who sat in the front but rarely asked questions or participated. He did fine on the homework and quizzes and seemed by all accounts of a normal child, but he was fanatical about sitting as close to the teacher as possible. Beecham asked around and found that he did the same in the other classrooms, too, and that in kindergarten, Ms. Wilson had to have several talks with Evan about boundaries because he would try to sit in her lap. Yes, Evan? What about holes? What are holes made of? This flash of lateral thinking took Mr. Beecham by surprise. What kind of hole are you talking about? Like a hole in the ground? I guess. Well, that's just space where the dirt has been cleared away and what rushes into it to fill it is the air. Even though you can't see air, it's also made of the same things, but those things are very loose, so we can move through them. Air is still oxygen, but it also has nitrogen and carbon in it, along with tiny amounts of other stuff. Good, clean air has fewer of those tiny amounts, and bad, choking air is full of tiny amounts of other stuff and has too much carbon in it, which is why it makes us cough. What about black holes? Evan interrupted, pulling Beecham back from his tangent. Like in space? Very good, Evan. Yes, there are parts of space where the gravity is so huge that light can't escape. Black holes are made up of the same things as everything else, but squeezed so hard together that it makes super-duper gravity. So imagine squeezing a piece of Play-Doh into the smallest shape you can make it, then squeezing even more and more until it gets so small you can't even see it. That's what's inside a black hole. Not Play-Doh, but a mix of everything. It's pretty complicated, and you'll learn more about that in a few years. But what about black holes here? This was the most Evan had ever spoken in one class session, certainly voluntarily. Beecham was torn between being delighted and concerned, but the class was attentive, clearly involved in this question about holes. So he dove in. There can't be black holes here. We'd all be swallowed up by their gravity. The only black holes are far, far away, and we're very safe from them. Evan pulled up his lunchbox from the floor beside him. He looked at Mr. Beecham as he was talking about how black holes are far away, then unlatched the box and opened it. Inside was nothing, just darkness. Black holes like this, Evan said. Beecham looked into the lunchbox. Was it painted with some special light-absorbing black paint? May I? He asked, gesturing to pick up the box. Evan looked uncertain but nodded. Beecham lifted the box by its sides. It was perfectly sound on the outside. But there was that gaping blackness inside with no shape, no edges. It stopped right at the brim of the box's inside. No noise came from it. No matter what angle he turned the lunchbox at, no light penetrated the blackness within, which was clearly not solid. But Beecham didn't want to. Have you touched this? The hole? No, sir. Beecham felt a war of curiosity and fear in his heart. The classroom may as well have vanished, so focused was his concentration on the void in a box. Have you put anything in it? Yes, sir. Like what? I put a grape in it yesterday. Beecham looked at Evan. He looked scared, like he was going to get in trouble. That's good science, Evan, a good experiment. And what happened to the grape? It fell. It fell into the hole? Evan nodded. Then what? Evan shook his head. Did it make any sounds? Evan shook his head again, more vigorously. And Evan, how long has this hole been here? Since yesterday at lunch. Have you shown anybody else the hole? Just Shara. It was her grape. Beecham didn't have a Sarah in his class. Some other kid then. He put the lunchbox on his desk and scanned his class list to be sure. It was still early enough in the year that he didn't know if some kids were simply escaping his attention. Suddenly there was a clatter. The lunchbox had fallen off the edge of his desk and landed face down, its lid splayed open and its solid metal bottom facing the ceiling. The kids in the classroom gasped, all except Evan, who was watching the box with rapt attention. Beecham bent down to pick it up, but Evan said, "Please don't," almost too quietly to hear. "What's that, Evan?" "Please, you won't be able to pick it up. It's going to be stuck for a while." Beecham gave Evan a quizzical look, then grabbed the lunchbox. But Evan was right. Some kind of suction force had fixed it to the ground. At least, Beecham presumed it was a suction, since the hole resembled nothing so much as the vacuum of space. In practice, it felt more like the lunchbox was now a structural part of the floor, and he could no more budge it than he could lift the school from its foundation. "Evan," he said carefully, "how long will it be stuck like this?" Evan shrugged. "It was like that all night in my room when my mom slapped it out of my hands, but this morning it was okay on the inside, and I closed it and put it in my backpack." "You showed this to your mom?" "She thought I was lying," he whispered. "She thought the bullies took my lunch, and that's why I was hungry." The bell rang. While this would usually have spurred a flurry of activity and chatter, especially given that it was the last class of the day, the kids remained in their seats, riveted by the lunchbox. "Okay, that's it for today. We'll see the end of this experiment tomorrow," Beecham said, standing and retaking authority. "Tonight I want you all to form an idea about what could be inside the lunchbox. A hypothesis, remember? You don't have to write it down. We'll just share ours before we pick it up and see what's inside tomorrow. Okay? Class dismissed." The kids shuffled out. As Evan walked past, Beecham touched his shoulder. "It's okay that your lunchbox stays here overnight?" Evan shrugged as if to say neither of them had a choice in the matter. After the kids had left, Beecham sat for a long time in his desk chair regarding the lunchbox. He gave it a few tentative kicks, but it was as immobile as ever. What could that be? He searched his brain. Despite being assigned to science, he was really a business major, not an academic with deep knowledge of astrophysics. Apparently, his minor in food chemistry was enough to qualify him for fourth grade science teacher. And this didn't exactly show up in his refresher course of the fourth grade textbook. He prodded the metal bottom, one surely wasn't strong enough to withstand the powerful forces going on inside, but it felt ordinary as could be, not at all under great strain. After a half hour of pondering, Beecham went home. The next day, the lunchbox was on his desk with a sticky note on it from the janitorial crew that said they had cleaned up the mess. He looked at the floor where it had been, but there was no trace of a difference. The lunchbox was just a regular lunchbox inside, albeit extremely clean. Being a teacher, he put it back on the ground with the lid open so he could complete the experiment with his final class and tease the kids in the previous classes with what could be inside. Were they too young for Schrodinger's cat? Maybe. Being a teacher and not an astrophysicist, he didn't have the sorts of stories in his feed about the Earth's magnetic field and the way it had abruptly reversed itself twice in a matter of 2 days. Being a teacher and not a geologist, he hadn't seen the chatter on bulletin boards about deep-level tremors that usually portended massive earthquakes, but this time had yielded nothing known. Being a teacher and not a psychic, he had no idea that his improvised classroom experiment would tomorrow yield the result of literal hell on Earth.